Is that Hotel California?
Yeah, I just watched a guy elbow drop a fish.
I would have never, if you asked me, what do you think that this audio is in the background of? I would have, that might have been the last thing I'd say. It's a man elbow dropping a fish.
You ever elbow drop a fish?
Oh, of course. What's is up? It vegan to elbow drop a fish?
Definitely not.
You don't think so?
Well, since vegans are hardcore with this stuff.
Oh, so like it'd be more like if they
be more vegetarian.
Chair shot. You gotta go hardcore. You gotta go hardcore. Hello and welcome to the Pretentious Movie Cheap Podcast. I guess that's the name for now until we come up with a different one. What happened to your?
My door fell.
What?
The surprises keep coming. My door just fell.
It just fell?
Yeah, it just fell. I was taking it off the hinges. But anyway, we're back to the Pretentious Movie Sheet Podcast. I'm your co-host, Christian Rocco.
I'm Brian. Welcome. yeah, so this is an extension of the Dead Meat YouTube channel. No, this is a spin-off of the Instagram page I got, Pretentious Movie Sheet, at Pretentious Movie Sheet on Instagram, Movie Sheet on Twitter, on TikTok, I think it's Pretentious Movie Sheet.
Not for long.
On YouTube, it's Pretentious Movie Sheet. Wait, I didn't catch what you said there.
Not for long with TikTok. That was...
Yeah, not before it gets the ban hammer. Oh, no.
For all those who don't know, both of us are very cheap. We're both college students. But yeah, no, we try and get our movies free if we can. And Vimeo graciously offered us the version of Godzilla where it is starring Alexa, Google Translate, Siri, and Stephen Hawking.
Yeah, it's all text-to-speech. And so... And it's kind of like the meme sounding like Microsoft Sam 1-2 words. It's something. But we shall cross that bridge when we get there.
It's dog shit.
That it is. Oh, boy. Because, like, look, Godzilla's like a fine movie. I feel like that definitely hindered the experience.
It definitely brought... And if anything, it made it a little more entertaining for me. I could not stop laughing at people begging for mercy from this mammoth-like creature while they go, brother, brother. Oh, no.
Yeah. Just to preface what this horror bracket is and kind of what we're doing here, over on my Instagram, I've been running a tournament via polls on the stories feature, where every couple of days I'll throw up, like, you know, Psycho versus Godzilla, which is the first match. The seeding for the bracket was based off of IMDb, Rotten Tomatoes, IndieWire, and Slate Magazine, their top 100 horror movies of all time. And they were given reverse scores. If they didn't appear on some of the other lists, but they did appear on one, for the list that they did not appear on, they received a score of 0. So I think the list had near 300 different... Oh, God. There was near 300 different horror movies. And the top 64 made it into the bracket. The seeding was based on the average... So, for example, Psycho had a score in, I believe, the 90s. I think it was, like, the top three for three of the lists, and then one of the lists was just silly. Like, I think, nothing against Rotten Tomatoes, but, like, the way that the scores are aggregated. I mean, the top horror movie of all time was Us.
That's not even the best Jordan Peele movie.
Yeah, no, it's not. And, like, look, Us is good. But Get Out's better.
and so is Keanu. Both of the movies that we're analyzing today, both of their remakes that are objectively better, right? Right?
Oh, of course.
They both came out the same year. Godzilla starring Matthew Broderick came out in 1998, and the Vince Vaughn remake of Psycho was in 1998 as well.
I think truly the cinephiles pick for the best remakes. Vince Vaughn, I think, is miles ahead of
Anthony Perkins.
Yeah. Like, clearly. If I want anybody in my movies, it's going to be the guy from Horrible Bosses, the weakest leading member of Horrible Bosses.
No, he wasn't in Horrible Bosses. Vince Vaughn.
Wait, wasn't he?
No, he wasn't.
Well, all right.
There you go.
Goodbye.
All the credibility for Brian goes out the window. Just scoot on your way. Somebody get that little cane to pull him off the stage.
I'm going to call Mandela Effect and say that Vince Vaughn, I came from a reality where Vince Vaughn was in that movie because I can clearly remember it. And clearly IMDb and you and everybody else around me must be wrong. And I can't.
Fair enough.
It was Bear Steen. I come from the Bear Steen universe.
I'm coming from a world where Kazam still happened.
What have you been watching recently?
Have I been watching? Oh, God. Well, given that this is a horror-oriented podcast, I've been trying to find my way, other than watching what we have watched already and that's on the docket today, I got the time this week to watch A House That Jack Built. Fantastic movie. Highly, highly recommend it. Maybe that's just me. I typically like psychopath films led by psychopath people. I mean, obviously that's why I let Brian handle this nonsense here, but what I'm saying is that it is a great film, top to bottom. I mean, I don't want to spoil anything because I know you haven't seen it, and
yeah,
I know many people haven't seen it, but I could not recommend this film anymore. It's very good.
It's been on my radar as like one of those movies that I really need to watch.
It's extremely disturbing film, and that's coming from me, who's seen it all. I mean, it is a very graphic, very... I'm trying to find the right words without spoiling it, but there are some scenes in there that are extremely disturbing that I didn't think a film would touch on.
Oh, really?
Yes, very.
Have you ever seen Dogtooth?
I have not seen Dogtooth, unfortunately.
That is on Shudder. I just randomly came across it. Like, I was like, I'll just review something random. Clicked on it because it had an interesting poster. This is really good. It's really messed up. Really good. Just real quickly on stuff that I've been watching recently. I saw Back to the Future this week for the first time, which shows
You haven't seen Back to the Future?
Yeah, I know. It just shows how qualified I am to run a movie review page. I haven't seen Back to the Future. I haven't seen Fight Club. I haven't seen Shawshank. I haven't seen the original Batman, Tim Burton Batman. I don't know. There's a lot of stuff I haven't seen.
I'm probably going to speak for a lot of people that don't want to say this. I guarantee you the masses of people that claim that they're these film savants haven't seen them either. They're just of them.
No, I'm totally in their ranks. The thing is, it's like, the movies I'm really into are like The Machinist and like stuff like that.
Oh, we've got an artsy boy.
Oh yeah. No, I'm totally unique and special.
Oh, we like independent films.
I like films where Tom Hardy's just in a car talking to people on the phone for an hour and a half. That's what I'm into.
I like films in languages I can't understand that don't have subtitles.
That instead have Microsoft Sam.
Exactly.
Alrighty. And with that, I suppose let's get to the main course.
And here's our PowerPoint transition slide. This is a checkerboard dissolve into the next point in the podcast.
This week on the podcast, even though this happened weeks, if not months ago, on the Instagram, We're doing Godzilla, which is the 64th seed, against Psycho, which is the number one seed. So, initial thoughts before going into this.
Ooh, both very iconic films, respectively, of both countries. One, I would think, spans the globe a little more, given that, I mean, you know, people in the U.S. still know quite a bit about Godzilla. I have no idea the cultural impact that Psycho had on Japanese filmmaking. Who knows if it had any? The reason why I think this contest is so interesting is the parents, because we could have done two very similar movies together. We could have done something like a Silence of the Lambs and a Psycho, right? But I think kind of comparing two wildly different films can really show the stark contrast in it and could quite possibly make this a little harder. That being said, I already made up my mind on what film I'm picking.
But yeah, no, I feel similarly. I'd say within the United States, Psycho, I think, has had maybe a slightly larger impact, but worldwide, Godzilla was able to penetrate so many cultures. And I wonder if you went outside of the United States, if you went to, like, say, somewhere in Europe, if they'd know Psycho less than Godzilla, like if Godzilla's a slightly more popular over there. But yeah, I think we're probably going to have similar rulings towards the end of this, but we'll save our votes towards the end. The way that I guess we're going to advance this bracket is, you know, you'll have a vote, I'll have a vote. If it's unanimous, which for these early ones, I imagine it will probably be, then that movie advances, obviously.
To the Electoral College.
To the Electoral College. If we disagree, however, we'll go to the poll that happened on Instagram, and that will be our tiebreaker.
Yes, sir.
All right. So, Psycho opens during a lunchtime in Phoenix, Arizona hotel. By the way, I'm reading off of Wikipedia, so...
Can I just say one thing already?
Yeah.
I still was blown away when I saw this. I did not realize this, that the opening of Psycho says Friday, December the 11th. That is my birthday. I think
it's
so cool that I can share that little piece of cinema. I also share a birthday with Rey Mysterio and James Ellsworth.
Hey, 619. And I have a picture with James Ellsworth. The Chinless Wonder. It takes place in December.
It does. I guess it's in Arizona.
Yeah, I guess I heard that in like really warm, sunny places, Christmas is not as big as a thing. I don't know.
I really didn't see any lights or trees during this.
No. So during a lunchtime in Phoenix, Arizona, hotel real estate secretary Marion Crane and her boyfriend Sam Loomis discuss how they cannot afford to be married because Sam's in debt. After lunch, Marion returns to work where a client leaves $40,000, equivalent to, guess how much it is in today's money.
I don't even want to embarrass myself. How many grapples?
It's going to be $351,000 in 2019, a cash payment on a property. Marion's boss asks her to deposit the money in the bank and allows her to leave work early after she complains of a headache, which I think she establishes even before she goes to work.
And you know something? It's starting to sink in. That's still really not that much money to completely abandon your life and risk life, or not life in prison, excuse me. You didn't murder anybody. But to have something like grand larceny, I just, to me, that really doesn't seem like that big of a payment. Even now, you couldn't really get that amazing of a life. I mean, yeah. $351,000 does not seem that much.
That would maybe allow you to, like, if you were to pay for, like, a new identity and, like, you know, get off the grid, that would take a sizable chunk out of your, like, out of that bunch of $350,000.
And on top of that, the money was there to help pay off Sam Loomis, I'm showing my Halloween fandom.
Well, it's Loomis.
Hey, is it Loomis? I thought it was
Sam Loomis.
Oh, well, I stand corrected. What happened is, it's because he has alimony payments, right? Because of his ex-wife.
I believe so. I'll be honest, I don't...
Very delicious opening, by the way, for a film from 1963,
62? It was very cutting edge. It's famously the first film to...
have a flushing toilet.
Yeah.
Like, even on top of that, like, we have a very, like, salacious sex scene that kind of still could pass for one today. I mean, it doesn't seem that much tamer.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, it's no Don't Look Now, which is the best sex scene in cinema history. But that was the first. We'll talk about that movie when we get to that movie in the bracket. But it is. I mean, like, he really was wanting to push the envelope. There was some concern with the film that I think, I mean, I think you'll see in that trivia on IMDb too, that Walt Disney would not allow Alfred Hitchcock to film on Disneyland's property. Because of Psycho.
This is true. And, you know, it's crazy too. Just going back to just the opening of the film, there are so many little hints and nods and little Easter eggs in the early part of the movie. After they have intercourse, you can see that he talks about his mother's picture on the wall. We're starting to see a lot of things people talk about their mother. It's very strange how he sets up a lot of things, and especially the way he shoots things. It's weird when he takes his like handheld approach, Hitchcock does, when he's looking at the money or what's in the bag, or how, you know, it's crazy how he just sets up everything that eventually comes to a payoff in the end, which, I mean, obviously that's what any filmmaker should do. But it's really interesting to see these little markers put in place for what will come later.
All roads lead to Mother.
All roads lead to Mother. There's so many amazing quotes in this movie. There's so many. Get someone who will lick the stamps for your ex-wife's alimony. A boy's best friend is his mother. A hobby passes time. This fills it.
I really, really love, and hopefully I'll be able to put a clip in this without copyright issues, but I really, really love Bastille's cover of TLC's No Scrub? Yeah, No Scrubs. And he mixes it, or they mix it with the XX's Angels, so it's called No Angels. And in the beginning, they have like mixed in with it, like in the intro, that is a lot of the instrumental from the XX, little clips from Psycho. And
fantastic.
It's the conversation they're having about, like, oh, you know, I help around the yard and stuff like that. Do you have any friends? We're all born in traps.
Well, I run the office. The cabins and grounds and do little errands for my mother.
Who's the psycho who created this?
Bastille. Yeah, but going back to what you were saying about, like, that really is not enough money to, like, it's enough money to probably cover up your own life and then probably, look, I don't know. I'm not a business major.
I don't know either.
it's maybe enough money to, like, start a new life. And then I can't imagine the leftover money would be much more than what she would have in her savings.
Well, even people say today now $1 million won't get you by.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is not $1 million. I just, that blows me away. I really thought that number would be much higher.
But yeah. So essentially she decides she's going to steal it. She's going to drive off to Verrill, California, and meet with Sam Loomis, and that they're going to, I guess, start a life together, because $350,000 is enough to do that. So we got our setup.
You know, though, back in the day, it was pretty easy to get away with murder and start a new life. Let's take that into account.
That's true. Getting off the grid was probably a lot easier.
Government started tracking our goddamn Canada Dry.
Canada Dry's got microchips in it, my guy.
Obviously, Canada Dry is run by the Mexican government.
Not even the Canadian one.
No, that's the big cover-up.
I see what you're saying.
You gotta think like the Mexican government.
Mexican government's playing 4D chess, I should say. So, she's on her road, and it's in front of this beautiful projected road that she's behind that you can find in so many Alfred Hitchcock films. See North by Northwest. She stops along the side of the road. She's stopped by a cop, isn't she?
She is stopped by a cop who also stops. There's another cop that shows up later that really doesn't go anywhere.
Oh, yeah. She switches cars.
Yes, she does. On a whim.
And the cop watches her.
The whole time. By the way, he comes up to her like Cool Hand Luke, stares at her with those nice little aviators, lets her off, and then she goes and switches her car out. This is the most mysterious behavior possible. Even the guy there going, I want no trouble, while he's staring at the cop who's staring back at him.
Yeah. Like she
does. A Mexican standoff of just suspiciousness, but it does, nobody has any bullets.
Yeah. And the guy who's like switching cars for her is like, is everything okay? And she's like, yeah, no, it's fine.
Yeah. I'll pay in cash. I have $700 in cash for a thing I didn't know I was going to do today.
Yeah. Like, aren't they offering services that like take longer than a day? She's like, no, I just want it right away. You know. So she does that. She switches the cars, but she's pursued up to the by the officer up until that point. And then I think after that, she stops being pursued?
Yeah, she just heads up to the Bates Motel. It's so crazy, too. Well, for one, I think we missed a really interesting scene. I just have this in my notes here. Do you notice when her boss sees her on the street anytime?
Oh, that's right.
That is such a Pulp Fiction moment right there. Marcellus Wallace getting... I was hoping she would run him over with a car, but we didn't see that. No, but I mean, we see her. It's crazy to see how, if you had no idea what Psycho was, you would think this is such a wildly different movie. There are two completely different movies, and then once it hits to this midpoint of the film, it changes entirely the second she arrives to the Bates Motel.
Speaking of Tarantino from Pulp Fiction, From Dusk Till Dawn is maybe my other favorite example of like, okay, we're doing a totally different movie now.
No, it's crazy to see how the tone changes entirely. It just seems like a thriller up to this point. And it's not until, you know, even when we meet Norman, he doesn't seem that strange. He seems awkward. There's definitely something off about the guy, but he doesn't seem very, very dangerous. He doesn't seem like someone who could harm a fly.
No, I mean, that's the thing. That Psycho has to be maybe the number one movie of like, wish didn't know the ending and then watch it with fresh eyes. Like, if you could go back and watch a movie without knowing the ending, this is probably the one.
It really is. It's just knowing, like, because I've seen the film prior to this experience. I rewatched it just to get, take notes and understand it more. Just seeing how everything just kind of plays out and is set up and just completely meticulous. It's fantastic to see the amount of craftsmanship put in a film like this. It really is. It's fantastic. Since we have arrived at the Bates Motel, we have met Norman, right? And, you know, one of the common tropes that I've seen with psychopaths in movies is the fact that these sweet, innocent boys drink milk. Have you ever noticed that? Great. Alex DeLarge was going to be my example as well. There are so many examples of psychopaths drinking milk, and I remember somebody did a video essay on it. I don't remember who it was exactly, But they said there's something to that childlike innocence of drinking milk, but somebody committing such a horrible atrocity is such a stimulus to your senses, and it just really throws you off.
Yeah. Anton Chigurh, another example.
Yeah.
You know, because of a heavy rainstorm, she stops at the Bates Motel. The proprietor, Norman Bates, invites her to share a late dinner after she checks in. She accepts the invitation, but also overhears an argument that she has between Norman and her mother. So we have this scene where they're having the dinner between Norman and Marion Crane. Also, Janet Lee, we should mention, mother of
Jamie Lee
Curtis. Yeah.
Best known for her role in Trading Places.
Actually, I was going to say Christmas with the Cranks.
Christmas with the Cranks is a solid Christmas movie.
Fair.
It is. It's solid for a 2000s Christmas movie.
One of my favorite parts of H2O, which I think you mentioned just a moment ago, was celebrating its
22nd anniversary.
Right. Janet Leigh's in it, and they have little audio cues that signal back to Psycho, which are really fun.
And that just goes to show how much of an impact Psycho does have in terms of the filmmaking in America. It's such an iconic film, and every moment in this film just, it feels so special, especially like this scene alone, where we're talking about just them eating sandwiches and drinking milk in a backroom parlor. But it's just the underlining tone and the subtext behind what they're saying, of when Norman says, you know, like, you eat like a bird, how he says he loves taxidermy. How is that going to come into play later? You know, the fact that he said he doesn't really enjoy this, that he has always had problems with mother, and that you kind of see, even she tries to be a little flirtatious with him, but you can kind of see like this weird sexual suppression in Norman.
I mean, there's something going on there.
There definitely is, and I think that was definitely a point that Alfred Hitchcock, I'm sorry, I'm not on a first name basis with him.
Man, all the people who are on first name basis with him, we all call him Al. Come on.
Oh, no, it's Hitch, hold the cock. No, but I mean, this is based on a real life murder that probably has inspired more films than Psycho, to be honest. The Ed Gein case, which has been covered to nauseam, but it's a similar situation of a guy who kind of lost it after his mother died, and his fixation over women and sexuality. His was a little more deep rooted than what Norman was. Norman didn't try and crawl into his mother's skin.
He ain't no Buffalo Bill.
He's no Buffalo Bill. But no, I mean, if we look at the original case, we can see that there definitely is some kind of something off about that. And I don't know how much Alfred Hitchcock dove into that, because I'm sure he has his own philosophies about the case. I mean, he studied it quite a bit when writing this. I have no idea what Ed Gein had, but maybe his problems with his sexuality led to a little bit more of the crime. I mean, obviously he had brain injuries and so many other things happened to him throughout his life, but him suppressing these feelings of wanting to be his mother eventually led him to snap and hurt people.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm somebody who's, especially within the realm of speech, we both come from a speech background. I've been a big advocate for how do we represent mental illness within media, and how do we portray it in a way that's accurate, in a way that's not going to mislead people. So, you know, the exact psychology behind characters like Norman Bates, I really don't feel qualified to say, but definitely within, you know, I think the movie is getting at, and they have that big scene towards the end where they explain, like, oh, Norman disappeared, and it was just mother after that.
funny enough, with that final scene, I think it's a really telling part where movies tend to not age well, but I think it's really interesting that Hitchcock had the foresight to kind of include a line like that.
Yeah, I think it was ahead of its time in that it didn't just blame violence on somebody being a little bit more fluid with their gender, which is something that horror has had a really complicated and checkered history with in terms of its relationship with being transgender or transgender characters. I mean, you look at, probably Norman Bates is the most obvious example, but you look at Sleepaway Camp, you could probably see some parallels in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. If you want a good deep dive in that, I think Dead Meat has a really good episode of their podcast that talks about that. But it seems that the violence that is created in this film, it really is made a point that did not come from the fact that he had feminine attributes and that they were at conflict with himself, but more so that they were controlling and abusive attributes that were forced on him via his upbringing and his raising by his mother.
It definitely, he was a product of his environment, and which is why I think it's important that we kind of see the fact that we find out what happened with Norman at the end, that he did poison his mother. His mother didn't, his mother wasn't as we thought she was. He was being around with another man, and that angered Norman because he wanted to be her world. Norman had a lot of repressed feelings, and I think talking about mental illness and when we portray these characters in film, in horror especially, because they seem to use that as a crutch of going, you know, the insane guy who's screws loose, something's wrong. I think that when we look at mental illness in this film, we can really see that it comes from a place of abuse and a place of neglect and repressed feelings rather than just, oh, he was born crazy.
Absolutely. And it's really nice too, because Norman is a really likable character. Going back to that scene, the hotel room, having dinner with Marion, they have a really pleasant conversation. It's one of the highlights of the film in my book.
In all honesty, I feel like I know people that are kind of like Norman. No, but look, you know, we kind of relate to these people who are a little shy and awkward and maybe a little childlike. I mean, but he doesn't seem any bit threatening. And even throughout the film, I mean, big reveal works so well because we think to ourselves, well, that Norman couldn't do it. It obviously was his horrible mother. Norman is caught up in a terrible situation and he's either brainwashed or has some kind of Stockholm syndrome with his mother, right? Because he cares about her. And we find out in the end, he still does care about her because he's taken on this life and this persona because of the guilt and all the feelings that he had inside him, that something just snapped.
Where they kind of go with it, they really do set up a motive that makes you believe that she was the one, because directly following that dinner scene is the shower scene, which is so infamous. And I think it's really interesting how they do set up that motive and really do set up that, like, oh, mother, who, I mean, of course, it's just Norman arguing with himself. Norman is, or the mother character is upset with Marion's presence. It does set up, like, oh, you, like, if you didn't know where it was going, you would know, like, oh. And they do set up that Norman is a creep too, because they do have that
the Peeping Tom scene,
right? Another movie we'll be covering that actually came out the same year, Peeping Tom.
Oh wow, both very iconic films. Do you know another interesting thing? And maybe this might be a little random to put in here, but to say that it was a stylistic choice to put the movie in black and white. Because up until this point, there had been color films. I think that speaks a lot to the ending as well, where he says, you know, it's not necessarily black and white. There's a gray area there.
Right. And one of my favorite pieces of trivia about this film also is that it was considered maybe too risky to be a feature. So they were going to make it two episodes of Alfred Hitchcock Presents.
Yes. Which if anybody hasn't seen that show, please go out and see it. It is early Twilight Zone, Black Mirror, whatever floats your boat in terms of that genre. It is fantastic. It really has aged well.
My dad keeps recording episodes. I need to watch those on DVR. But, in terms of the shower scene, which comes up next, I mean, what can you say that hasn't already been said? It's maybe one of the best edited scenes ever. And in terms of, what editing is supposed to do and using it to communicate things, especially things that you don't actually see, it's the best, you know?
And you know, people tend to criticize Hitchcock for how brutal he was on his actors during the scene, but I guess it really does show in the final product. I know they said he was very anal about the scene, very picky. He had it done a million times. One thing that I hear all the horror stories about working with Hitchcock, but the one thing that kind of stuck out to me, and this might be silly, is she had to hold that shot for quite a long time, just not blinking, completely focused on her eye.
Right.
I can't imagine how excruciating that was.
You know, it's a big thing in film to, you know, pick out when you see a dead person breathing, but at least they don't have to keep their eye open. I'd rather hold my breath for a little bit than not have to blink for a while.
Yeah, and that shot was directly on her eye. That was the focal point of that shot. And I still, that scene has been probably the most recreated scene of any horror movie, I think. I mean, can you think of another one? I mean, this one's been done to death on The Simpsons, on kids' shows, on anything you can think of.
Looney Tunes, back in action.
Exactly. it's really something when you go back and watch these scenes as they happen and just realize that, you know, you're watching history.
Yeah. So directly after that, something that I didn't realize when watching this for the first time, we have a good 15 minutes of Norman cleaning up, which, if I'm going to be honest, I know people like to rag on the last little bit, people like to rag on the psychology scene at the end. I think this is the worst part of the movie.
You're telling me that when he takes that curtain off and it ends up on Pawn Stars, God knows how many years later, he signed it. Yes, it was on an episode of Pawn Stars. Somebody owns the screen used curtain that
really?
He picked up. Yes. And it's signed by him too.
How much did it go for?
I don't remember, but I still remember that. But
that's
no,
wild.
Ryan, you really just took away somebody's livelihood. You just devalued somebody's prized collection.
It was on there for a good that extra 5 minutes of screen time really racked up the value right there. Excuse me. COVID. Yeah, no, I mean, I guess it kind of sets up, you know, Norman is a really nice guy. He's willing to do a lot of dirty things. And maybe I'm just too used to modern. Yeah. So we go to Sam Loomis's shop and we have Leela. Is that her name? Leela?
The sister?
Yeah.
I believe so, right? See, I'm the worst person with names of people in films.
No,
I usually just call him by whatever the actor's name is. I know I'm not getting immersed into the film, but I think it's crazy that to this point we've only had one main character.
Oh, and on that too.
Yeah.
People like to talk about how this inspired stuff like Scream.
I was gonna say Scream.
I don't think any film. When you think about when Marion Crane dies, it's halfway through the film.
I was going to say the same thing.
Yeah.
That Scream essentially was just a misdirect. If anybody has seen the movie Life, everybody thought it was going to be the Venom prequel, but them purposefully killing off Ryan Reynolds in the beginning of that film is a huge misdirect to go, oh my God, anybody can die. Ah, in the case of in Psycho, this is a major death. We have lost our point of view. We have lost the narrative of the story.
Which, like, look, you know, like stuff like Life, stuff like Scream with Drew Barrymore, you know, they're subversive. They're some of the highest billed actors / actresses, but they don't commit and get the audience as invested as much as Psycho does. So it's, I just find it kind of funny that people make those comparisons all the time. To just wrap up Psycho, you know, we have Sam Loomis and Marion's sister. They go to the Bates Motel. We also have a detective that's also trying to track down Marion. He gets killed, and one of my favorite parts of the film as well, he gets slashed, and then he's like falling down the stairs in this way that physically does not make sense but looks really cool.
I like that even though he's dying a slow, painful death, he still manages to get his footing perfect down the stairs while we're walking backwards.
Yeah.
a single step.
He just glides. He floats. He does float.
Yeah. He is levitating.
Oh, is this part of the Stephen King universe? Is he floating too?
Oh, he's got the shine.
He's got the shine.
Got the shine. I got the shine.
That another film on here, which I think will go very far in this bracket.
The Shine.
After that,
The Shining.
The Shining. The Irish. Is that from The Simpsons?
Is it?
I forget.
I'm saying The Shining. The Shining.
They we then focus on Sam and Lily. They are investigating things. They pose as like husband and wife. And Norman's like clearly covering stuff up. He's acting real suspicious. I think he like erased Marion's name out of the guest book. Eventually, Lila? I don't know. She goes up to the Bates house.
Girl number two.
She goes up to the Bates house and she turns around mother's corpse and she's dead. Oh, I forgot to mention earlier. They said that, like, they go to the local authorities and they're like, oh yeah, Bates is there with his mom. And they're like, oh, his mom died 10 years ago. Oh,
you know? I picked out that Pennywinkle, whatever 1960s color that is that doesn't exist anymore. I didn't know colors got dated. I didn't know colors expired. There's nobody that has a Pennywinkle blue dress anymore. When was the last time somebody had a Pennywinkle blue dress?
Honestly, I could not tell you what color Pennywinkle is. Is it like a blue?
I assume it's some cross between the two colors on your shirt right now.
So she's dead. But I feel like when they set up that mystery and they're like, no, she's been dead for a while. If I were watching this for the first time, I'd be like, oh my God, what the hell?
Yeah. I also think it's really funny when Norman comes into the house and she's trying to hide. Norman goes upstairs. The door is right there. She could easily have just ran out the door. But no, she goes into the fruit cellar.
Well, because she's like...
She's investigating.
Curiosity killed the cat?
Curiosity did kill the cat. And I like that Norman had the foresight to go get changed upstairs before she even screamed. Because he was down there within seconds of her touching that light. Going...
The lighting of that was really cool.
It was.
Where it's swinging around.
One thing another thing that we also maybe didn't cover is that we see Mother right after they say she's been dead. He's carrying her down the stairs.
That's right.
Down into the fruit cellar.
That's right. He's like mobile with her.
She's immobile. So that kind of makes it a little strange since we saw her standing up before.
Yeah.
We saw her standing, standing up in the shower with all this vigor and this force in this fight, but now she's this frail, feeble old woman.
I didn't even think about that.
Because you see her legs, she's a dummy. Her legs are kind of like going crash test on us.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, so the execution of that's good. Then they have the wrap-up scene where the psychologist comes in and is like, well, I'm gonna explain to you, like, Kirk Cameron, how all happened.
Was it really on the nose? Yes. But I thoroughly enjoy that scene, and I still love the final monologue.
The final monologue's great.
It is fantastic, and I love that we hear it from the mother voice rather than Norman's. And I think that's also the thing that really throws off the audience, too, is the fact that I guarantee you Anthony Perkins didn't do that voice.
Oh, no way.
There's no way he had that. Well, maybe, who knows? There's been stranger things that happened. Also, by the way, between the time of everything being said, since I ramble, I can multitask since I don't know what I'm saying. That psycho shower curtain went for $500 if anybody's looking to purchase that. Anybody has a couple of
little Price is Right fans, take notes.
Please. No, that final monologue is great, and I love that it's not Norman doing it, because Norman never was a menacing person. We even though they share the same body, they are two different characters. And I think that it's amazing that Hitchcock even says that the mother has been playing Norman this whole time, saying, I wouldn't even hurt a fly. Dolores.
Of course, Anthony Perkins went on to be in the following two Psychos, both of which are, oh, and then like another TV movie.
You know, Anthony Perkins was quoted in this, that he said even if he was told that he would have been typecast in the Norman Bates role, he still would have taken it.
Oh yeah.
He said as much as like this really did not necessarily ruin his career, but kind of limited it. It was very much worth it. And how could you argue this? Is there a more iconic... How about this? Is there a movie that has had as much longevity in terms of a horror film like Psycho? The fact that we still talk about it today, that the fact that we still can reference it and that young kids would still know it. I doubt many movies from the 60s still have that staying power.
I would throw out something like Frankenstein or Dracula.
But I feel like the universal monsters have kind of become like those public domain characters.
Yeah, they don't hold the same. I don't think the same prestige and pedigree that you would put Psycho out there with, though.
Yeah, because I would say like Dracula or a vampire or a Frankenstein are kind of like, I'll put it this way, or like a generic store-bought costume, right? You can go see them at a CVS. You can grab them real cheap.
If you had to rate it out of 10, what would you rate it?
God, that's so hard. I'm going to give it some extra points, especially since I think it's way ahead of its time. I'd say a solid 9. Maybe I like doing the Rotten Tomatoes type score of like percentages. Say anywhere from like the 89 to 93 range.
Yeah, I think I put it right there, like a light 9. I respect it probably more than I'm like crazy about it. Like, oh, I could watch this 1,000 times and be hype about watching it 1,000 times. It is a really well-made movie. And obviously it's iconic, and I feel like you gotta kind of grandfather it in a little bit too, but it's really good. It's really good. I could certainly see why it is so crazy for people, especially when it first came out.
People were afraid to take showers.
Yeah.
It truly did terrify people. That's the mark. Especially like, we'll look at Jaws later, but there these films that scare you from doing daily things or interacting with daily objects. That's quite a feat.
Yeah,
it's a waste of hygiene.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's Psycho. Godzilla. 1954. Of course, Psycho, directed by Alfred Hitchcock. This one, Godzilla, directed by Ishiro Honda, which my apologies if I'm very dyslexic, so please forgive me. When the Japanese freighter Iyoko Maru, my apologies, is destroyed near Odo Island, another ship is sent to investigate, only to meet the same fate with a few survivors. A fishing boat from Odo is also destroyed with one survivor.
That part's in English.
I was confused by the wording. Because it says fishing catches mysteriously dropped to zero. So they're saying like nobody's catching fish these days. Blamed by the elders on an ancient sea creature named as Godzilla. Reporters arrive on Odo to further investigate. A villager tells one of the reporters that something in the sea is ruining the fishing. That evening, a storm strikes the island, destroying the reporter's helicopter, and Godzilla, briefly seen destroying 17 homes and kills 9 people and 20 villagers' livestock.
If you guys are looking for a serious viewing of the film, I don't necessarily recommend this because...
Just pay the $3 to rent it off YouTube.
It really is funny though. And maybe that might hinder it, I guess. But I really could not stop laughing at just some of the delivery of the lines, and not from the actors themselves, by this speech to text program.
Though, if I'm going to be honest, I hear the English dub does not have much more care. Given,
I feel like that one's iconic. There's a similar problem I think that kind of took me out of the show. I really gotta watch it again because I hear how good it is. Have you seen the show Dark on Netflix?
I have not.
I think it's in German. I could be wrong, but they try very hard to line up the dubs with the mouth movement, and sometimes it's seamless, but sometimes there's just something slightly off and your brain's just it's hard to digest that. It's now you're just staring at their lips rather than what's going on. To me, I guess it's just really distracting. And I guess you kind of have to either understand the language or a better dub than what is there, because it truly does take away from the film in terms of the serious aspect of it. The overall filmmaking, though, is really incredible. Between the models and the explosions and everything else, especially for the time. That's the thing about Psycho and Godzilla. Around the time that these came out, these were really cool cutting-edge choices that these filmmakers made. I mean, it's no Jason in the Argonauts where it's completely wildly years before its time, but it's cool to see people getting creative with what they had.
There are certainly some times where Godzilla is very clearly a guy in a rubber suit. And I would even argue that when we first see him poking over that mountain in broad daylight, which, you know, I'm not against things being in daylight, scary things being in daylight, but at the same time, it does look a little goofy, but at the same time, if that's your first time seeing that or something like that I'm sure has got to be something. Beyond that, a lot of the special effects are pretty great. And you look at things like later on, they have a scene where Godzilla really hits the mainland. And the way that these power lines are melting, it looks so good.
It does. And it just speaks volumes to the people that were innovating at that time. I'm sure models were used prior to that, but really bringing them to life by, and I think seeing something actually moving, which I'm a huge practical effects guy. I'm not anti-CGI, but I think there's a warmth to practical effects. Had Godzilla come out in the 90s and they were using very, very crude CGI as opposed to very crude practical effects, I still would take the practical effects. Because I think
we did have Godzilla in the 90s.
We did have Godzilla in the 90s, that is true. But I'm saying a really shittily done CGI version of Godzilla, because I know they did use practical effects for some of the scenes. But
yeah, I mean definitely in that Matthew Broderick one, if I do remember correctly, there is actually some really bad CGI, if I remember correctly.
There is, but I would say that I would prefer shitty practical effects over shitty CGI, because at least with practical effects, there's a warmth there, because there's somebody that's operating it. There's somebody that's putting care into it. I don't know.
Absolutely.
To me, it really immerses you more into the film. But yeah, no, I am a huge proponent of using those kind of effects. And CGI isn't bad. I'm not trying to necessarily shit on CGI, because there are times and places for it. And God, CGI has come a really long way, guys. I mean, we see people like Rocket, who are entirely created by that, and every follicle and hair and piece of dandruff on him has been sculpted perfectly. But I really do think that, like you said, there are some really corny moments and parts where you're like, this is obviously a man in a suit.
Just particularly when I think about the way that the costume folds. It folds in a way not that like a reptile's skin would. It folds in the way that rubber would.
I agree. To me though, it really, looking at it from now, I just think it adds to the movie. I really do. I do. I think it speaks to the amount of effort that was put into it, even though it may have not turned out exactly the way it did. And also, like, we're watching these things in high definition now. I'm sure if you watch that in the theater, you wouldn't notice a certain crease or fold.
No, that's very true. So the Oda residents, they travel to Japan to demand disaster relief. The villagers and reporters' evidence describes damage consistent with something large crushing the village. The government sends a paleontologist to lead an investigation on the island. And I really like this paleontologist character. One thing that I will say is, like, when you have an antagonist that physically large, it is hard to have like a single character, like, because it's impacting so many lives, it's hard to have like a single solitary character that is being the main character affected by all this or going up against all this. I think this film handles that issue particularly well.
I do too, and I was kind of worried about it in the beginning when entire ships were being blown up and people were just dying randomly. I'm like, is this movie full of NPCs? Right. But no, I mean, they really try and create and I think this is kind of what, since Godzilla doesn't have really, I know they try and develop more personality to the character in other films, but he can't speak, he can't really emote that much. You have to kind of create a community to kind of make up for the lack of personality, I would say, from the main antagonist.
That's something that I've been kind of a little bit worried about with whoever the next Avengers, like Thanos level character is going to be, because some people are saying Galactus. And I just don't, when somebody's like physically larger than Earth, how do you have that same character dynamics that I think made so many people interested in Thanos?
That's when you introduced the Silver Surfer.
There we go.
But no, I understand, and it's kind of funny to say that the it's weird since the namesake of the movie is Godzilla, but it's really the people that carry him on his back.
Yeah, well, that's true. So the paleontologist goes to investigate things. They find a giant radioactive footprint, and trilobites are discovered, which I think are those, if I recall, they are like ancient forms of, they're like extinct marine life. The village alarm bell is rung, and the paleontologist and the villagers rush to see the monster retreating after they're seeing it. And I think that's when you see it in the daylight over that mountain. You see Godzilla So the paleontologist presents his findings to Tokyo. And I really, I gotta say, it is kind of stark in a current day and age where science is being questioned so much when he's like, okay, we have like scientific evidence backing that there's this big freaking thing coming out of the ocean and destroying the world. We need to kind of take this serious. And people are pushing back and being like, bah!
Well, that was the thing I think was really interesting, because I watch Godzilla and I just see so much of Jaws. I really do, because we don't initially see the monster at first, and it's kind of hidden for quite a while. And then that really kind of took me there, because it kind of reminds me of the mayor of the town going, ah, you know, 4th of July is the biggest record sale of the year. Ah, don't forget about it. No, but I think that it's kind of weird that they would still deny it when there's a giant footprint and extinct life showing up. To me, I don't know. I'm sure people would question it now. Insert name of politician from whatever group says so. They would believe it, wouldn't they?
Right, yeah.
So I can't trust any politicians.
None of them. But
that's why I'm voting Kanye West.
This podcast officially... No, just kidding.
It's going to be so dated in a couple of weeks.
They conclude that the reason that Godzilla has been awakened is because they've been testing with hydrogen bombs. And obviously this film has a lot to do with that theme of the atomic bombs that were dropped on Japan by the United States. And clearly that is the big...
Wait, what? Wait, that's what this is about. No, this is a joke, right?
I think we're breaking new ground here.
Jesus, the way this world's going. Between, I said between plagues, meteors, what else has happened this year? Wars.
Murder hornets.
Blowing up. I don't think Godzilla's out of the range of possibilities for 2020.
This has to feel like the end times, doesn't it?
It really does. You always say what could get worse, but then you hear, oh, we might have to start wearing goggles now, or this might last another year of us wearing masks or continuance. Oh, there's more outbreaks and they're increasing at twice the rate they were in the beginning.
It's what a time to be alive.
Want to die.
Aren't we blessed?
Anywho,
we have some attempts to kill the monster. The paleontologist has ideas on how to kill the monster. Godzilla survives all of these attacks. So at the same time, it starts to focus on his daughter, Emiko. She decides to break off her arranged engagement to one of the paleontologist's colleagues, Dasuki, I believe. Amika rescues the reporter from Serizawa's home. After Serizawa refuses to divulge his current work to the reporter, he gives Amika a demonstration of his recent project on the condition that she must keep it a secret. The demonstration horrifies her. So he creates a machine that basically takes all of the oxygen out of water, correct?
In all honesty, the science behind it was... I don't understand.
It's definitely fiction. Definitely
intelligent, I guess. I don't
definitely
know.
Leans into the science fiction elements.
Especially like, and I was gonna. I don't know if I should save this for the of Godzilla. But unlike Psycho, Godzilla has had many sequels, iterations, and additions to the character. Not just films, even. So, what is canon and what isn't kind of confuse me. So, I don't know if the science necessarily made sense to the people writing it.
Yeah, and in a way, I mean, like, if you look across the board at all the science fiction that was being produced in the 1950s, because that was the zeitgeist.
Really well. The magazines and films were the biggest thing at that time.
Yeah, I mean, like, because you had not only the atomic bomb, but just so many advances in technology and, you know, lifestyles were being revolutionized by the way that electricity was really picking up. I mean, obviously electricity was like a thing decades prior, but it was...
Our modern homes as we know it were kind of being developed. People were starting to really gravitate towards the TV, even though not many homes had it, but we started seeing like things like refrigeration and air conditioning.
Suburban living.
Yeah. Your idealistic white picket fence house.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, I like you were saying, it was such a revolutionary time at the time, I guess. Any sort of science sounds wild and fantastical.
Truly. Yeah, but, you know, so this oxygen destroyer obviously has a lot of parallels also to atom bombs, which, I mean, there are a lot of things going on between Godzilla and between the way that he woke up via the hydrogen bombs and also this oxygen destroyer. They're all kind of representations of the hydrogen bomb or atom bombs. In that way, it gets a little messy in terms of the metaphor, I guess. But that being said, yeah, you know, the science is very indicative of the way that life was changing. But overall, you see a lot of the same guilt in the way that Oppenheimer probably had with the atom bomb.
Yeah.
That the same character has, and he ends up killing himself with his own device.
I also think that, you know, I don't think it's any sort of coincidence that we see, like, these massive death tolls in the film, where entire cities are being leveled.
And, like, nuclear radiation that's coming from Godzilla and impacting the people afterwards.
Exactly. I was just about to bring that point up. No, I mean, this absolutely is an allegory for all this that happened, God, just a decade before. I mean, people were still reeling. It was only a decade removed, and probably not even that. I mean, it came out in 1954, correct?
Yeah.
There you go. I mean, that had quite a lasting effect on Japan.
In the way that you see, like, in the decade following 9/11, there are still a lot of films like The Strangers, stuff that kind of evokes the same themes of, like, people being hurt for random reasons. And, you know, it's that's something I've really enjoyed about the horror genre at whole, is how it helps us kind of explore.
It's an entertaining form of social commentary, and it's weird because they've always been, and we were talking about this with Psycho, they've always kind of been on the cutting edge and the cusp of a lot of greater fears. And maybe that's why they work so well, is because these are all fears that we probably had inside and didn't want to talk about.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, and I think that's one of the big things that makes Godzilla as good as it is and as iconic as it is. And of course, you know, it went on to be just a really iconic character. But if you had to rate Godzilla out of 10, what would you give it, my friend?
Godzilla out of 10. Now, I don't think it's a bad film on its own. But that being said, I don't think the story's amazing. I think it's an iconic film. If I were to rate it, probably give it a 70. 7. Just a 7.
Yeah, I'm right around there too. I think I gave it like a strong 6 to a light 7 on the Instagram, which I think, and not always, I guess, the number ratings will always dictate like what we say will advance in the bracket. But I suppose you think, I suppose we both agree Psycho advances this week, right?
Psycho will absolutely advance. It is a tighter, stronger film overall. While Godzilla has a lot of very innovative, amazing, kind of fun little filmmaking techniques and special effects that really captivated Japan for decades and still does. I mean, we are in the midst right now of a cinematic universe starring Godzilla in the United States. Godzilla is a more iconic film But Psycho, absolutely, without question, is a classic film. It is a better film overall. I can't say that Godzilla has a better story than Psycho. I can't say it is tighter in terms of the directing than Psycho. And it, I mean, we kind of get lost on the acting, so we can't really we can't really judge that. But I probably would say Psycho probably has that too.
I would have to agree. And I wonder, because I think the scale of Godzilla also holds it back a little bit. It is a very large scale story to tell in a 2-hour period, less, I think. In the 1950s, I'm pretty sure they were much shorter, like a half hour and a half was probably longer for a film at that time. But when you look at the scale of it, it's a lot to accomplish in a small amount of time. And for that reason, I think it should be commended. But I wonder, because you look at something like World War Z, that book follows a lot of different characters, if I remember correctly, and it's able to take that scale and make it work to its advantage. I wonder if you adapted it, if you adapted Godzilla to a book, which I'm sure there have been book adaptations of it, but that might work better and be more grandiose than something like Psycho as a book. I haven't read either, but I wonder.
I was going to say, that's the one thing, and I'm glad I never would have thought of it until you kind of brought this up. You're saying the scale of Psycho. Think about it this way. I enjoy Marvel films. I really do. I am a huge nut for them. That being said, I wouldn't put Infinity War in the same category of what would be nominated for Best Picture for the Oscars. It is a fun film. It is a very enjoyable film. It's a film that you can rewatch and enjoy a bunch of times, but Psycho is an overall better film. While it's not as culturally significant as Godzilla, it's just leaps and bounds above it in terms of just storytelling. To me, what makes a movie is the character.
Right.
Where we're talking about characters we enjoy in Godzilla, nobody talks about that. But yeah, I mean, the star of the film is Godzilla, and there's really no development in Godzilla. Norman Bates, and we see him as a character, and we gravitate towards him. And like you said, the scale of Godzilla doesn't make it an intimate story. Psycho feels that way. You get to know the characters. You get to understand them. They're very simple things. Psycho isn't the most gruesome horror film because not many people, only two people die on screen in the film.
Yeah.
It's the moments like when they're sitting down drinking milk and having sandwiches, or where they're driving in a car in a panic. Godzilla has very big moments, but none that truly stick out in my mind other than the scenes of just seeing the monster for the first time, or watching him collapse, or just a bunch of those kind of like big, more grandiose scenes. I think Psycho, other than your little shower curtain scene, all right, right. Every scene matters. Everything matters in that film. Everything feels special.
Absolutely. And it's going to be quite the... next week we're looking at Peeping Tom and Jaws, and not trying to spoil the next one, but I imagine we're probably on the same page of what's probably going to advance from that, which is going to face Psycho in the next round, which is we're all ready for a decision like that to be in the second round. Oh boy
It's gonna be a difficult one.
Absolutely. Are there any socials that you would like to plug?
Yeah, if you guys want to follow me on Instagram, you can follow me at ChristianRocco41. Or you can follow me on my professional wrestling account. I'm at RealJCopeland. Go Patreon, do whatever you guys want for anybody else. I'll take this time actually to promote some other people. Go ahead and watch the Saw Monster Sounds Off podcast, last podcast on the left. You guys haven't do something nice for somebody. People really need some good shit in their life, and just a phone call or just to chill with somebody or just make fun of them lovingly would really go a long way, because it really sucks right now, and I'm sure somebody could use it.
Absolutely. And we got on Instagram, even though I don't know how you found this podcast if you aren't already following one of my socials already, but the Instagram is Pretentious Movie Sheet, the Twitter is Movie Sheet, the YouTube is Pretentious Movie Sheet. Just look at Pretentious Movie Sheet on any platform. You'll probably find me somewhere, except Facebook. I don't have a Facebook yet. But yeah. Any closing thoughts?
Investigate 311, I think it was an inside job.
Investigate 311.